Welcome, SMQB listeners, to episode 169. We're recording this on June 17th, a few hours before Game 5 of the NBA Finals. And we're being brought to you tonight by Assembly Software, the best legal case management software in the business. Joined tonight by House and Pope. How are you guys doing?
What's up, Rooster?
A little nervous, but doing good.
All right. Well, we're sorry to be missing Bison and Milk right now. We're thinking Milk may join us later, but we'll see. Let's jump right into it, guys. Who are you bringing to the bar tonight, Pope?
I'm going to bring Bryson DeChambeau. We'll talk about him more later, but I would just love to have a beer with him and just talk about what happened yesterday and how he's transformed himself from, like, you know, Bryson the burly man to Bryson the man of the people, and is now, you know, probably one of the most popular guys not on the tour, but, you know, playing golf right now.
Yeah, also kind of Bryson the robot into Bryson Mr. Personable.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting. How about you, House?
During the NBA Finals telecast, while Pope was cheering on his team the other night, there was an interview that they had with Joel Embiid where he suggested, implied that he'd like to have Paul George added to the team. And I'd like to have a beer with Daryl Morey to say, don't do that. We already went down this road with James Harden. Can we get, like, a young up-and-comer that can develop? I don't think Paul George is the answer, so please give me the opportunity to go to the bar with Daryl Morey, and I can dissuade him from that bad idea.
I think I agree with you. I am going to take to the bar Mr. A.C. Cowlings, Al Cowlings,
yeah,
who 30 years ago today was involved in that two-hour low-speed
Bronco
chase in the white Bronco from the police with O.J. in the car, brandishing a gun and potentially threatening to kill himself. Now that O.J. has died, I'd like to take Al to the bar on the anniversary and say, spill the beans, baby. What did O.J. tell you in the white Bronco that day that you haven't told us?
So Al's still with us.
I'm not really sure about that, but I think he is. That was also that night was game five of the Knicks Rockets championship series. So can't believe it's been 30 years. It's amazing.
Alive and still alive.
Al?
Yeah.
Good.
Born in 47.
Didn't he play for the Raiders?
I don't know about Al Cowlings.
I think he did.
I know OJ was buddy-buddy with Marcus Allen and that whole Raiders connection, but I don't know about Cowlings.
Yep.
He played with OJ at USC.
Ah, okay. Okay. All right.
And yeah, we played it with them, Buffalo.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about the U.S. Open, guys. Scheffler was the big favorite and just didn't turn out that way. What I'd like to ask you guys is just about your viewing enjoyment. Do you enjoy watching a tournament where the greatest golfers in the world are hitting good to great approach shots that land 5 feet from the flag and then roll off the green? I mean, I find that to be not amusing. What do you think, Pope? You like it?
100%. I love watching those guys struggle. I love watching them try to get up and down from impossible positions. It just makes you feel, you know, like these guys are more like us sometimes than it would appear. I mean, and their ability to get up and down. I mean, we'll talk about Bryson's shot in a minute, but, you know, just time and time again, their ability to get up from impossible positions, side hill lies, you know, the mounded greens. At Pinehurst is just one of the more fun courses to watch those guys try to struggle.
What do you think, House? They're not like us. They're great. And the course is designed like a carnival course to make them look bad.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a little bit mixed on this. I've been going back and forth in my mind. Did Bryson win? Did Rory lose? And I've come to the conclusion that the course won. And I just...
So the USGA won?
Well, I guess.
They set it up that way.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I'm a little bit somewhat like Pope. For example, when they have the British, when they have the Open, and the rain and wind is going sideways, and, you know, you're putting across a double green 50 yards, it's kind of fun to watch that. But, and that is where golf started, right? I mean, that's the origins of golf. But there aren't a lot of courses that are built like Pinehurst. And so is this really the true test of golf? I just feel very mixed about it. I too, and you know, we can get as in depth as you want about what was at times hard to watch, Rory's collapse. But for me, it started with a shot that landed on the green and by all measure, under any circumstance, would have been a good shot.
And five. It
just kept, I think he hit the ball the right way and it just kept trickling and trickling and trickling until it fell off the green. And I don't know, does that mean that Rory's not a good golfer? I feel like he executed very well. Obviously, he didn't execute the putt well, but I think Rooster asks a great question. It was sometimes enjoyable to watch, to see them struggle. And like you said, Pope, to see them hit these miraculous shots. But other times it felt like, are we watching just kind of like a circus?
Well, but I mean, you know, U.S. Opens are test your entire game. Look at Shinnecock. I mean, Shinnecock greens were arguably worse than Pinehurst the year they almost lost the greens. They had to water them down in the middle of the round. I mean, this is what the U.S. Open does. It is a test unlike any other. And I think, you know, out of all the majors, it is the most likely to, you know, be a train wreck. And that's, I think there's some enjoyment. Maybe it's perverse, but there's some enjoyment in watching these guys struggle. But yet, you know, they find a winner like Bryson that's hits the shot of his life, one of the all-time great U.S. Open shots. So I don't know. I mean,
listen, I agree with you there that you guys heard me complaining at the PGA that Valhalla was too easy.
Right.
And the scores were and I was like, this is ridiculous. This is not even fun when they're scoring 18, 19 under. I do like over 4 days, the best golfers in the world, the best they can do is -6 over 4 days. That's pretty enjoyable. That alone.
Yeah. I mean, there were what, like 6 or 7 guys who were under par for the whole week? I mean, yeah. That's a U.S. Open.
Big names didn't even make the cut.
Right. But to your point, House, and move on. Brandel Chamblee identified on the shot, second shot coming into 5 on that par 5. He said that Rory had struggled with his irons all week and that even though he hit a good shot, it was a little off. He should have hit a fade and not a draw. If he had hit a fade, then the ball would not have got up on the green and gone left. The ball would have continued on the green and it would have fed down towards the flag. He said he just mishit it a little bit. But, you know, that's what it requires is an exact shot. Now, was it
luck? But how about on 16?
Well,
on 16?
Well, but was it luck, though, on 5? Remember that Cantlay hit essentially the same shot and his ball rolled down into the bunker versus rolling down into some crevice that he couldn't hit out of? I mean, that was luck. That was bad luck. But sometimes that's what happens in golf.
Well, you know? Rory's consolation prize for bogeying 3 out of the last 5 holes is he got $2.3 million for second place. Thank you, Tiger Woods, I guess, right?
Well, that's interesting that you should say that about Tiger, because what we saw yesterday at Pinehurst compared to the prior Pinehurst was these are all these courses, particularly at US Open, being Tigerized. And that course played so much harder. I mean, you could see you saw the images on television about the approach on 18 yesterday and this weekend as compared to the last Open. There was so much more waste area and that wiry grass. It was a challenge. Look, the other thing is this though, Pope, on 18, like if the Open isn't set up with wires and, you know, that duck hook that he hit on 18, if there's no spectators there and there's no wires, there's no stuff there, that thing is gone. That ball is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of ironic. It wasn't really, it's spectator golf that allowed him to even.
Well, no, he didn't hit a spectator on 18. On 18, he didn't hit a spectator. He almost ran all the way through the wiry grass, and he got caught up behind a tree, trunk of a whatever, a root of a tree on 18.
Yeah, but wasn't there also like wires and stuff like that, television wires and stuff like that involved?
Not on 18.
Was that Rory's shot? That might have been Rory's. Anyway, it's not.
No, Rory had a duck hook that he got hit. He had a fan, should have gone further left.
Right.
And then he had the wires. They had to move the wires, and he had a fairly good lie. But here's an interesting thing. I just looked it up because we're talking about it, right? 2014, Martin Kaymer won at Pinehurst. He was -9. Guess what the next golfer was?
I forget.
Ricky Fowler, -1.
Yeah.
Martin Kaymer had an unbelievable week. Otherwise, Pinehurst would have won that round, you know, that U.S. Open as well. So Pinehurst it's just a difficult course, and it identifies over 4 days the golfers who don't make the mistakes. Look, Rory's mistake was on 18. I believe it was McGinley, I think, on Golf Channel last night. He's like, yeah, Rory didn't hit a bad putt. He just did a bad read. The problem with Rory was he hit the ball too far on his approach. He gave himself a 4-foot slider downhill. He should have kept the ball below the hole. He missed the putt.
Yeah, after the last episode, Pope, you were talking about Johnson Wagner's recreation shot.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
See the one he did out of the bunker? That was fun.
That was epic with Bryson.
Yeah, Bryson, he's in on the 18th bunker where Bryson hit that amazing shot, and his first attempt flew the green. Then all of a sudden Bryson appears and rambles down into the sand trap,
carrying the trophy.
Encourages him to try it again, and he hits pretty much the same shot Bryson hit. He had a nice shot.
Well, he hit it to a foot.
Yeah.
So the two things that keep going around about the tournament was, of course, Rory was -8 on the 15th tee. Okay. And of course, Bryson won it at -6. So Rory was -8 on the 15th tee. So put that in one box. Bryson's bunker shot from 55 yards, they say that the chance of hitting it within 4 feet was 1.7%. And as Pope said, one is the greatest clutch shots of all time, let alone in a U.S. Open. So you just have to choose one. You have to choose one, guys. Did Rory lose it? Did Bryson win it?
I think Rory
lost it.
I think it's 50-50. I really do. I think when we look back, so when they come back to Pinehurst, you know, and it's on the road, I don't know when, but those two shots, the 16 and 18 putts missed and Bryson's bunker shot, are going to be played over and over again. I mean, those are the two indelible things that you leave with from this tournament. Bryson's bunker shot, though, I think will ultimately be what people remember, because it's just like Payne Stewart, the symmetry in 1999 when Payne had to get up and down against Phil, and he, you know, hit the ball in the rough, and he had to get up and down. He had, what, that 20-25 foot putt, whatever, and he made it. Bryson had to get up and down to win, otherwise go to a playoff. And I don't know if you guys remember this, but back in 99, Phil was about to have his first kid, and there was, back then they did 18 hole playoff on Monday, and there was talk that Phil wasn't going to be able to make it because his wife was going to, you know, go into labor. He said he would leave. So literally, you know, Payne got up and down and prevented that scenario from happening. And you can't escape the SMU symmetry either, with Bryson and Payne both getting up and down in Pinehurst to win, you know, an epic U.S. Open.
But Bryson shouldn't have been in a position to win it on 18. Rory was up two, five holes to play, and bogeys three of the five, including missing a putt that was like 3 feet and another one that was under 4 feet.
No, he missed.
All Bryson did was stay at minus six. He didn't birdie coming in or anything like that.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, on 16, McIlroy missed a 2 foot, 6 inch putt. He was 496 of 496 of the year for the year and 3 foot and less putts before that putt. So, yeah.
I mean, have
that,
we seen,
that was clearly nerves.
Have we seen this from Rory historically that he gets in between his ears? I don't remember that being part of the problem in his game.
Well, you know, he lost at the old course, the Open a couple years ago with Cam, but Cam shot a 64. I mean, Rory did not play well, but, you know, Cam had to come out and get him. I don't think that I don't remember Rory crumbling under pressure like this.
Yes. Right.
This is devastating. I mean, you saw him. He spun out of there. I mean,
anybody would. It's crushing.
Well,
I'm 2.3 mil will help maybe next week, though.
Yeah, Rory's past money, though. You know, he flew home on his G5. In fact, I think he was out of there before Bryson had even done his press conference.
Yeah, that was not a good look. Let's move on to the NBA Finals. So after game three, I think it was House sent around the clip of Brian Windhorst excoriating Luka for whining and not playing defense. Pope, do you think that piece from Windy motivated Luka just a little bit to play some defense in game four?
Clearly it motivated him. I think it motivated the entire team. I'm not saying that they wouldn't have done what they did without Windy's, scoring him. But I think, you know, the thing that when you look at the whole series, though, is that the Mavericks actually, I read a stat, their defense against Boston has not been that bad. In fact, if they have the defense, would be rated number one in the NBA for this series. Now, Luka gets highlighted because there are a couple times where he got frustrated with the refs, was whining on the floor, trying to, flop, and they had 5-on-4s, and, they pressed the lead in game three especially. But I don't know if Luka played much better defense. He just didn't whine in game four.
Yeah.
He moved his feet. Yeah, whatever.
He moved laterally a lot with a lot more intention, I thought.
So one of the ways in which I like to celebrate Father's Day is arguing about sports with my kids. And so I brought up this thing about how Luka all of a sudden showed up to play defense in game four. And my son Josh said, number one, Luka's been playing hurt. That in the first round before really the injury came on, he played good defense in the first round. And number two, that stat that keeps getting kicked around about the blown by, there's a stat that, Luka is in the highest percentage of plays where he's blown by for a basket. And he said that's basically how Dallas's defense is set up in a way, and they have two of the better shot blockers in the whole game. They allow that collapse of defense to happen so that they could be rim blockers. So it's not like Dallas is playing outside of their game. Luka is playing hurt. That might have stifled his defense. We'll see if he's still got enough to bring back that same kind of D. But I think if Luka and that team doesn't play with the same exact intensity, and on a foreign court now in Boston with Porzingis probably playing, I don't know. I think that was a nice win. I'm glad Pope was there for it. I think this thing is still over as of.
You're saying that about their defensive strategy just calls to mind the lost art of the pull-up 16-foot jump shot.
Right.
Jason Tatum needs to figure this out. If you blow by Luka, don't go head down, ramming towards the hoop where you're going to get blocked by one of two guys, pull up for a 15-foot shot. Why not just take two the easy way?
The elbow shot is a lost art.
Nobody does that anymore.
Kyrie does that some.
Yeah, Kyrie does that. I feel like the story, once you get by all the the drama of the stories that people are creating around Luka and Jason Tatum. The story to me is scoring efficiency. And Jason Tatum is the most glaring example. In the games where he scored a lot of points, he has taken a ton of shots and missed a ton of shots, and they're bad misses. He's missing threes, leading to transition points going the other way. And in game four, he was 1 for 4 from 3-point land and 4 out of 10 just, you know, field goals. He's just not being very efficient. And I don't see him as a top five player in the league like he sees himself right now. He's just not stepping up to do that. The guys who I think have been extremely efficient at times in certain games are Kyrie, when he's had good games, and Jaylen Brown. They're not taking as many shots and they're getting their points. Not every game with Kyrie, but I think it was in game three.
Not in Boston.
Yeah. But I just, and Luka can falls into that trap too. When he scores a lot of points and is taking a lot of bad points, if he's not making his threes and he keeps taking them, that's great for the Celtics, because they're getting the rebounds, longer rebounds. The rebounds are getting away from Lively and Gafford, and they have a better chance of getting them, because without Porzingis, they're struggling to get rebounds under the hoop.
Another thing that I'll just say this, that another problem that the Mavs have at winning another game, let alone three more, that we were talking about yesterday in the house, was that almost every single player on the Celtics is capable both of hitting the three and playing defense. They just keep running so deep, like not just even their starters. One after one after one, you go through each and every single player. They're all capable of hitting a three. They're all capable, not just like a three, multiple threes with a high percentage and playing D. I just don't know how the Mavs keep facing that game after game for another three. It would be remarkable. And a lot of people are rooting for them to do something that nobody else has ever done. But I don't think it's going to be possible.
Here's how bad, you know, the odds are. There's only been three teams in the NBA Finals that were down 3-0 that even forced a game five. Wow. There's only been four teams have forced a game seven in NBA history. Last time, Boston did it in the Eastern Conference Finals last year. They came back from 3-0 against Miami, and they actually had the home game and lost, which was a shock. But here's the one that sticks out to me. Only time ever in a championship final of the franchise that sports that have seven games, which are baseball, basketball, and hockey. Only time ever in a championship finals a team has come back from 3-0 to win was the 1942. Shout out to you, Moose Jaw, Toronto Maple Leafs over the Red Wings. That's
what about it? The Red Sox over the Yankees?
Wasn't a championship series. That was ALCS.
Oh, right.
And that was the only time ever in baseball. So, you know, only one time has a team come back from 3-1, and that was the Cavs over the Celtics in 2016 with Kyrie, which we have talked about.
I think the Celtics did that to the Sixers. The Sixers were up 3-0 or 3-1 against the Celtics.
Definitely wasn't 3-0, because never happened in NBA history 3-0.
Well, yeah, that wouldn't have been the finals. That would have been the conference championship.
Yeah, that would have been conference championship.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm talking about NBA finals. 3-1. Yeah. It is really, really tall odds. But the only thing that, you know, you kind of grasp on is that if somehow Luka can steal a game, which, you know, he hadn't stole a game yet this series, if he can do that, then the pressure will be enormous on Boston in game six in Dallas to not go back for a game seven. So
What's your prediction?
I think the Celtics close it out. I don't think it's going to be close. I think it'd be 15 to 20 point win
tonight.
Totally agree.
Rays banner number 18, drinking green beer, all the shit you guys
I think
did.
That's true too, because if they don't, man, I agree with you. They're going to be off some awfully nervous.
There's a lot of sphincter tightening.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Now, let's move on to the NHL, because I think that might be different. I think that it might be easier to come back from 3-0 in hockey than it is in basketball, because of all the shifts and all the team play, etc. After that 8-1 blowout in game four. Do you guys think that the Oilers stand a chance?
No.
Nope. I think they blew their oil.
What in the world finally awakened that offense so that they exploded like that?
You know, it's the same thing as the Mavs game in game four. Talk about fun from a fandom perspective. It's fun to watch these teams play with that level of desperation.
Desperation, I mean, urgency, and pride.
Yeah, but let's not forget the Mavs also held the Celtics to 35 points for the entire first half. So there's defense being...
Oh, yeah. There. Yeah. I mean, all around, sense of urgency in both sides.
But eight points in a hockey game, that's like scoring 20 in a baseball game.
Yeah. Look, they're loaded.
Or being up by 48 points in the second half, which is what the Mavs were over the Celtics.
That's right.
They're loaded, but I think they still got to come back to Florida. And I think that Florida is now going to play with a level of desperation. I think the same thing is going to happen. I think this thing ends in game five and two teams are going to raise the banners in the next couple of days.
I think Florida in six.
So you think Florida is going to lose at home and then go back and skate the cup in Edmonton?
I'm hoping the Oilers ride the wave of that last victory and get one more, but I don't see them winning it.
So between the two teams that are down 3-1 right now, Mavs and Oilers, you think the odds are Oilers have a better chance? I do.
Yes.
Yeah, I do too, just because it's hockey. So, hey, since we're talking about this, I got something out of the mailbag that I wanted to read. I meant to read it last week, and I just forgot to print it out. But cousin Justin wrote in after episode 165. And said, I'm a big fan of the pod. I've listened to all 165 episodes, but I need to call you out on a few items, one of which was Moose Jaw claiming that he predicted Edmonton would be in the finals, when in fact, cousin Justin went back and listened to the actual original prediction, and Moose Jaw predicted Colorado over New Jersey in episode 136.
Suck it, Moose Jaw.
He says we need to have some accountability on the pod. and along those lines, House, here's what he had to say to you: keep your filthy derby bets to yourself. That was horrible advice on your box superfecta. I thought the SMQB's NCAA bets were bad, but you set a new low in episode 162.
Well, Justin, hopefully you bet on Tony Finau to finish in the top 10 or top 5 based on my prediction in golf last week.
Yeah, good one.
And to Bison, he says, your seeding for the greatest baseball movies of all time was almost as bad as your seeding for the best Girl Scout cookies.
Ooh,
wow.
I love it, Justin. Bring it. You are so right.
Wow. Hey, cuz.
Yep.
Now, I do think Moose Jaw, though, when we did Stanley Cup preview, did he not, before the playoffs began, did he not pick Edmonton?
At that point,
he did.
At that point,
that
yeah.
He had. He
no, at that point. That but yeah, I mean, beginning of the year, he was wrong.
Yeah.
As I'm sure we all were.
Yeah. All right. So let's move off of NHL now, House, and tell us about summer soccer. We got Copa America and Euros to look forward to. Tell the uninitiated what those events are.
Listen, audience, if we're right, well, actually, no matter what, this week before our next pod, we lose two major sports. So we're down to baseball. And right now in baseball, I don't know, there's about 8 out of 32 teams or whatever that are relevant. So it's the dog days of summer. So you want to turn on for the next 3 weeks your channels that have soccer, because there are two amazing competitions with the best soccer teams, athletes in the world playing right now. The Euros, the UEFA Euro 2024, it's only played every 4 years. It's being played in Germany right now. They just started the group stage. In fact, they've not even been through all the group stages, the first game yet. There's still group F that will be played tomorrow, Portugal Czech Republic, Georgia, and Turkey. But the favorites are England, who are just loaded with talent, including Jude Bellingham and Saka on group from Group C. You've got a loaded German team in Group A, a fun what we call group of death, given the talent in it, in Group B with Spain, Italy, Albania, and Croatia. You've got Netherlands and France in Group D, including Mbappe in Group D. You've got Romania, Slovakia.
Mbappe playing? Or is he just sitting out for the...
He played today and actually scored today kind of on an own goal. It was a terrible goal that was surrendered by Austria, but Mbappe set up that goal. Today, just if you want to tune in and see some of the excitement and some of the unpredictability, today the number three team in the world, Belgium, Kevin De Bruyne, among many other very, very good players, lost to the 42nd team in the world, Slovakia. It was a shocking upset. It turned out that Belgium had two disallowed goals, one off offsides and one off of a handball. But it's great soccer. That runs now the group stage for the next couple weeks in Germany. The quarters will be July 5th and 6th. The top two teams out of every group come out, plus two third-place teams, to make it an even 16 teams. And then the semis, July 9th and 10th, and the finals on July 14th. While that is going on, when you flip off what's going on during the daytime on your TV set, here in America, the Copa America, of all the teams of North, Central, and South America, the best teams, here you've got four groups. Argentina leads Group A. Ecuador leads Group B, U.S. and Uruguay lead Group C, and in their group of death, Group D includes Brazil, Colombia, Paraguay, and Costa Rica. Brazil and Colombia are very good. Paraguay is half decent too. So they also play in group play over the next, from June 20th, Argentina plays Canada this Thursday night to start it off. And after the Argentina-Canada game gets going, then group play goes to July 2nd, the quarterfinals, July 4th, 5th, and 6th. Pope, you should try to get to one of those. One of those is in Dallas. The semifinals are July 9th and 10th in New Jersey and in Charlotte. And then the final will be played July 14th at Hard Rock Stadium in Miami. Here in Copa America, you're getting a chance to see Lionel Messi. You're getting a chance to see a loaded and young Brazil team. And of course, the U.S. may be their best team that they've had in many, many years. So it's a lot of exciting soccer. Other than the World Cup, if you like the World Cup, you'll love watching Copa and Euros. And it's nonstop soccer. If you want to get the soccer bug, now is the time to do it over the next couple weeks.
Tubby, isn't this the biggest set of tournaments before World Cup?
For sure, yeah. So outside of the World Cup in 2026, these are the big ones. And it's always fun watching them play for country as opposed to their league play. These guys are – listen, just if you watch the Euros, just watch them do each of the country's national anthem before the group stage games. These guys on the team are just – almost yelling out the national anthem. They're very, very pride, you know, very full of pride in these.
A lot of passion with the Euros watching these. I saw it went viral. The Albanians, did you see what they did to the Italians?
Breaking the spaghetti. It's
breaking
hilarious.
Spaghetti and throwing it up in the air.
And then
they tied them, didn't they?
Yeah. And then the shocking result. The Austrians we're breaking off baguettes in front of the French fans. It was hilarious.
Take a break there for a second, House. Did you mention whether Ronaldo was playing in Copa, or is the Saudis preventing him from playing?
I think Ronaldo is ultimately going to play for Portugal. But even if not, Portugal is a loaded team. There's a lot of players that are not as well known on the world stage, of course, as Ronaldo, but Bruno Fernandes, from Manchester United is likely to be a dominant player on the pitch for Portugal, as well as a number of other very Portugal's definitely a top 5-6 team in the world, with or without Ronaldo.
All right. Good report. Does anybody have a punchable face this week? I'm sure there are more than one. Don't call it a comeback.
I have one in the mailbag. I'm going to try to leave out the cursing from this. But this punch comes from one Patrick Meichler of Tampa, Florida. He's also known as Milk on our podcast. If I don't make the pod today, please punch that little B, Rory, on my behalf for leaving the course and refusing all interviews. Sore effing loser and little B. I leave the rest of this in your hands. I think Milk has a point, you guys. I mean, I get it. I get how upsetting. And Rooster, you said anybody would have kind of the same reaction. You got to face some music. I mean, you are making, like you said, $2.3 million. Get in front of the press and friggin' say, it sucks. I hate losing. I can't believe I missed the putts. Whatever. Driving off like a little baby?
Here's what he should have done. He should have waited after he putted out and after he did his little celebration thing, and he should have congratulated Bryson. That's exactly what Bryson did for Xander when Xander got, you know, that great bunker shot at PGA, and he was able to get up and down and win. Bryson stayed around, and Rory should have done. I get he didn't want to do a press conference. No problem. But he should have done one short interview with whoever from NBC Sports. And that's all, you know, maybe a couple questions, answer a couple questions, and then he could have left. By leaving, he made it a bigger story by just stomping out how much, you know, of a jerk he was by doing that.
Wouldn't you engender sympathy and say, this poor guy, when he gets in front of the camera and says, this is the worst day of my golfing career, it's going to be hard to get over this one. Hopefully I will, but I got to go. This was rough. People would be like, oh my God, I feel so bad for Rory.
Congratulations to Bryson. That was an amazing shot, and he's a great, you know, champion, whatever. And just do something. And I was waiting all day, actually, for there to be something on social media that Rory had reached out to Bryson to congratulate him or apologize or something like that, which nothing. He didn't even need nothing. I mean, his handlers have got to have gotten in front of him and told him to do that, because
he's losing for Rory.
No, I don't know. I think it's a punch. I was going to punch.
Full punch. Punch.
Yeah, it's full a full punch.
All right. Full punch.
It's a full punch. I mean,
all right.
You know, you got to be accountable for that kind of stuff.
I've got one too. I'm going to punch Bill Belichick.
Why aren't you going to
go? It's 2024.
As opposed to a high five?
No, it's 2024. 72-year-old men do not have any business dating 24-year-old competitive cheerleaders, especially when you look like Bill Belichick.
I think she's an ex-cheerleader.
She's a competitive cheerleader now, Pope. There's apparently a difference.
Jordan, I see.
Jordan with an O-N at the end, Hudson. And Bill met her 3 years ago on an airplane when she was only 21, and they were talking about her homework assignment on the plane together. Her philosophy homework. I mean, yeah, that's just creepy. Bill Belichick has a daughter old enough to be Jordan Hudson's mom. It's just gross at this point in our history to be dating someone that much younger. Anyway,
I'm glad the SMQBs is taking a stand on this, Rooster.
Yeah.
Can we give a punch warning? Have we ever done one of those that you're about to be punched? Because I'm just telling you that Angel Reese, you are walking on some very careful ground right now. You're really. All of this, like, oh, crowds are really showing up for me, and oh, I guess someone's getting a special whistle tonight. We get it. You don't like Caitlin Clark. We covered this last week, but some of this stuff, that was a flagrant one. Maybe it was unintentional, but she swung her wrist across her face. And so Chris Nace Bison just wants to tell you a punch is coming if you keep up with this. I'm sure he would say that.
All right. Try.
Make sure the transcript. Make sure the transcript is clear.
It's take one step forward that. with our women listeners and three steps back, and all in 5 seconds. Who's got a lasso?
Barbecue sauce.
I just have a quick lasso. You guys remember, I don't know, maybe it does go as far back as the pod, but there was a time where we were talking about the very, very scary moment when essentially Christian Eriksen from Denmark died on the field.
Yep.
And it was during the Euros. They had replayed, well, not replayed, they did the Euros belatedly after COVID. And he actually, for a little bit, died on the field. And most people didn't think he'd play competitive soccer again. He's gone on to play again for the country, Denmark, and for Manchester United. But the other day was his first time back on the pitch in the in this same competition, the European 24 competition. And in the 17th minute, he played a phenomenal game the whole game, but in the 17th minute, that guy, Christian Eriksen, scored a goal. And if that's not like a Disney movie, I don't know what is. A guy that goes in that same competition from dead on the pitch to a serious heart situation to scoring the very same competition a few years later, that, my friends, deserves a lasso.
Yeah, it sure does.
I think we've already talked about this, and I won't keep it long, but I think a lasso should go to Bryson. The way that he honored Payne Stewart by after he won, you know, he looked to the camera and he said, "This was for you, Payne." He had a Payne Stewart pin on the back of his hat during the entire final round. And just the way his demeanor was, and he said, "You know, when I went to SMU and I saw the mural of Payne Stewart on the wall, I knew I wanted, when I was recruited, I knew I wanted to go there." So there's a lot of symmetry there with Bryson, and I'm just so impressed, you know, by the way he's handled himself after this win, and he's definitely got a fan in me now.
Nice.
All right, nice lassos. Let's move on to buzzer beaters. Who's got a buzzer?
I'll just say the Major League Baseball might end up being a survival of the fittest. What happened to the Dodgers over the weekend is a big, big deal. Losing both Yamamoto, who might be gone for a long time, and Mookie Betts to a fractured hand, which I'm guessing is going to be 4 to 6 weeks. The Phillies are just getting back Trey Turner today. They're getting back Brandon Marsh, but their main guy that's been driving the great pitching on the Phillies, JT Realmuto, is going to be out for 6 weeks. And their pitching has fallen off in the last, you know, few days. There's been other injuries already. Keep an eye on the Dodgers to see, obviously, the Braves with the biggest ones with Strider and Acuna. But keep an eye on what happens to the Dodgers if they survive this as well, because Mookie Betts is a huge engine for that team.
You know, sticking with Major League Baseball, knock on wood, but unlike most recent years, the Yankees are actually about to get a little healthier. Gerrit Cole is coming back for his first start Wednesday. And the guy they called up out of nowhere to replace him, Lewis Gill, we talked about before, the guy, he's 10-2 and has a 2.03 ERA. It's just out of nowhere.
Unbelievable.
It really is. It's remarkable. Hope, take us home.
What, you want a buzzer beater?
Yeah.
You got one for us, Pope?
I really don't. I mean, I was going to talk about Major League Baseball too, and Max Scherzer is due to come off the IL and get his first start of the year, which is just in time since the Rangers are now 8.5 back from Seattle after getting swept. What a difference a half a year makes, at least, from the glory of winning the World Series to being out of the playoffs and not even considered a factor.
A lot of baseball left.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, listeners, we're coming back to baseball. Don't worry. It's 162 games. The worm will turn. We'll be back to baseball soon enough.
All right, listeners, we love hearing from you. It's smqbsmailbag@gmail.com. Let us know if you've got some Cousin Justin-like complaints or some things you'd like us to talk about. Look forward to hearing from you before the next episode. Thanks.
The SMQBs are Brian Bandwagon Pope, who hails from Dallas, Texas, and has never met a first-place team that he didn't have a personal connection to. Michael Rooster Phelan, hailing from Richmond, and who roots for teams from New York, or is it Boston? I can't remember which it was. One or the other. Also, Patrick Milk Michler from Tampa Bay. And he is still massively in love with Tom Brady and will never get over his man crush on the GOAT. Toby House Milrod, a long-suffering sports fan hailing from Philadelphia, whose Eagles team, they're still looking for another quarterback. And I am Chris Bison Nace, hailing from Washington, District of Champions. Thanks for listening.